From a quarantine studio brought to you by KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. With the coronavirus pandemic bringing the country to a screeching halt and changing life as we know it in the U.S., the most important election of our time has also seemingly been halted in its tracks. The biggest story before the pandemic was declared was the primary race for the Democratic nomination for president. Turning his candidacy around at the last minute, former Vice President Joe Biden appeared to be a frontrunner with a nearly insurmountable delegate lead. But now, with much of the country under quarantine, is Biden's campaign also on life support? Not only is Biden struggling with visibility, he also faces a growing enthusiasm gap. And most troublingly, in recent days, an allegation against him of sexual assault has emerged. My guest is Branko Marchteach. He is a staff writer at Jacobin Magazine and a 2019-2020 Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting Fellow. We had talked to him recently about his new book, Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. Welcome back, Branko.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, of course, when we last talked to you, it was before Biden's candidacy turned itself around with a lot of help from various Democratic Party folks. And here we are yet again with his candidacy seemingly flagging, although he still retains a pretty big delegate lead against the only other candidate in the race, Bernie Sanders. And then came this sexual assault allegation by a woman named Alexandra Tara Reid, who was an aide to Biden when he was senator. You've written about this, as have others, and Reid herself has been giving interviews. Can you give our audience a sort of thumbnail sketch of what the allegation is and why it hasn't gotten very much attention from the corporate media?
Well, Tara Reid was a staffer with Biden in 1993. She served with him for about 9 months. And at some point in that tenure, she says that they didn't have really a relationship or anything, you know, in terms of boss and employee. She would see him around and he was very, you know, nice to her and sort of, you know, he would smile at her, wink her and all that kind of thing. And then she says one day, she went to bring him his gym bag, I believe. And he, according to her, pushed her up against the wall and started kissing her and groping her, and he ultimately penetrated her with his fingers. She's told the story in a number of places and how it's affected her life and also her career as well. It's really had really profound implications for her, long-standing implications, as you can imagine, with anything of this seriousness. It is kind of puzzling why it hasn't received really any mainstream media attention. If you think about some of the really big news outlets in the United States, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, really just no mention of it whatsoever. Biden had an interview with Chuck Todd on Meet the Press on Sunday. And he also had a town hall on CNN about the coronavirus pandemic. In neither case was this brought up, despite the fact that at this point it had been, you know, days old. And at this point, it's picked up a little more mainstream media attention. It was in a column in The Guardian, Newsweek covered it, Huffington Post covered it, but still it tends to be either more left-leaning publications that have covered it, or, and this is particularly, it tends to be right-wing media, so Fox News, Daily Caller, National Review, that kind of thing.
Which means that Trump will bring it up when if he faces Biden in the general election.
Absolutely. I'm surprised he hasn't brought it up yet. Perhaps he's just sort of keeping his powder dry. But it will definitely come up again. And, you know, it may well, we may well see that what happens is the media is keeping quiet on it now. And then later on when Trump brings it up, or, just if someone else maybe comes forward, or if the issue maybe flares up some months down the line, if Biden ends up clinching the nomination, I would expect to see the media really kind of hit this very hard in the same way that In 2016, even though Hillary Clinton got a much rougher ride from the media, really the whole way through, the media kind of went above and beyond to show that it was, you know, not just anti-Trump, that it really was critical of both candidates. It really went hard on her for certain things, particularly the emails and some other issues. So I expect that would probably happen. Why this is happening? I mean, on the one hand, you know, it's not clear whether there's stories in the works from people. I have spoken to Tara now, and you know, she says that she has been contacted by reporters at various news outlets. Whether that's because there's a story in the works, I don't know. I think it also should be noted that she told me that what people are asking her are things along the lines of, you know, going through her financial history, you know, that she, I think, declared bankruptcy at some point, and other things along this road. So really, things are completely irrelevant to the allegation, but things that almost seem like they're kind of meant to, I guess, throw doubt on her allegation because of, you know, very irrelevant facts about her character and her financial standing. Which of course is a very different standard to what we've heard for the past 4 years when it comes to sexual assault survivors. So yeah. I think that's one element of it. But I think there is, I have to say, a little bit of hypocrisy here that I feel like with a prominent Democratic official, especially one who is set to go up against Trump, and you know, may well have already clinched a nomination. It's not clear. We'll see how things pan out. But it seems like a lot of people who otherwise would have been talking about this, even if it is still an allegation and a lot of outlets haven't looked into it, the silence from it to me feels like it's a way to kind of, you know, protect a candidate who people are seeing as the main vehicle to get rid of Trump, which, you know, if that is the case, is quite shameful.
Well, Ryan Grimm, writing for The Intercept about a week ago, said that Time's Up, which was the fund that was formed by prominent, you know, Hollywood activists and others in the wake of the hashtag MeToo movement gaining steam after Harvey Weinstein, Time's Up refused to fund an investigation into this particular allegation against Biden. And they basically said that they couldn't because it would jeopardize their nonprofit status only because Biden is running for president, which is quite bizarre because, you know, basically implies that one is off the hook if one runs for president. And it's not like Biden is, you know, that this came out of nowhere. Biden has faced allegations of inappropriate touching, violating the personal space of women in the past. And so this isn't like one allegation that came out of nowhere in an otherwise sort of spotless tenure or career, right?
Yeah, in 2019, there was a series of women that came forward and talked about their discomfort at how he kind of, how he would touch them, you know, sometimes kiss them or stroke their shoulders or in some cases kind of really put his head in their hair and all this kind of thing. And these women said they found it uncomfortable. I mean, it does have to be said that those allegations, well, you know, serious and should be taken seriously, are not as serious as this one, which is really outright sexual assault that he's been
right. It's on the spectrum, but one end of the spectrum, and this is certainly further into the spectrum, closer to actual rape, if not rape. I mean, depends on one's legal definition. And obviously the impact that it seems to have had on this, on the accuser is very much like what rape victims and survivors struggle with. Now, you've also pointed out that there are some Democrats who are justifying, in an article you wrote for Jacobin magazine, some Democrats are trying to compare what Biden is facing to what Al Franken faced. There's been some sort of mea culpas from the Democratic establishment for throwing Franken under the bus for allegations that they say are now, you know, just weren't serious enough, and he was kind of sacrificed at the altar of the Me Too movement, and maybe Biden is facing that same sort of treatment. You're saying Joe Biden is no Al Franken.
Well, so what happened with Al Franken was that he was accused of, you know, groping and kissing a woman without consent when he was on a USO tour years back. Then, you know, woman after woman came forward with similar stories, namely that, you know, whether they took photos with him and he groped them, or he tried to kiss them, or something along those lines. And what happened was the pressure built up enough, and this was, you know, right in the middle of the kind of Me Too moment in late 2017, and a group of women senators, Democratic senators, and basically confronted Chuck Schumer at one point and said, you know, something has to be done here because this is getting really bad. And ultimately, 32 senators, Democratic and independent senators, there were a few Republicans too, came forward and called for Franken's resignation based on these allegations, which, you know, had not been investigated by an ethics committee, but they were pretty serious allegations. So what's happened now, given that precedent, you know, that they asked someone to, you know, not someone who was running for president, but someone who was a sitting senator. So, you know, a lower rank than where Biden would sit if he won this election. I got in touch with those people because I wanted to see what response they had to this allegation, especially given that a number of those senators had actually endorsed Biden, including Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, and probably most significantly, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Who really, she led the charge on the Franken resignation. She has really made defending the rights of sexual assault survivors and fighting for their right to be heard kind of a core part of a political identity. And I reached out to them and I said, you know, what is your response to this? And in the cases where they endorsed them, are you still standing by your endorsement, given this is an allegation that's even more serious than what Franken faced? I can tell you, out of the, I think, 29 that I got in touch with, only a single one even got back to me. And that was Sherrod Brown of Ohio. And he just kind of gave me a statement saying, I will always, you know, I think women should have their stories heard, and I will always fight for the right for that to happen. Everyone else did not. You know, in Gillibrand's office, I spoke three times with her press assistant. I the first time we spoke, I told them about it. I said, you know, I can send over the interview that Tara Reid did on The Hill's Rising. If you're not familiar with it, they said, yeah, that would be good. I sent them material, spoke to them, you know, three times over the course of several days, emailed her communications director a couple times, and I just got back complete silence. You know, they said, you know, we'll look at and see if we can provide a statement for you, you know, over the weekend, and nothing happened. And I think that is a real, it's very telling, because there was a real moment to, or an opportunity to make this this Me Too moment that happened in 2017 something bigger than just politics. You know, it's very easy to sort of Republicans to say, well, this is all lies, because the Democrats are just using this to sort of attack our people. You know, Trump, Roy Moore, the alleged pedophile who ran in Alabama, Brett Kavanaugh, of course, which really the whole party coalesced around defeating, and on the basis of believing the allegation against them. But the Franken thing, the Franken case, really pointed to an opportunity to make this about more than just partisan politics, to show that there is credibility behind when a woman comes forward to talk about you know, what, an assault or any sort of misconduct that happened against her. And I think with this, the silence of these prominent Democrats, especially ones who are really, really led the charge on this issue, their silence has, I think, really hurt the, it's going to hurt the credibility of any future survivor who comes forward if she accuses a Democrat or a Republican. You know, people will just say, well, you know, you didn't believe this person when it was politically inconvenient, so why should we trust you now when you're saying this person should be heard?
Right. And of course, as we mentioned earlier, these issues will come up during the general election. In addition to the sexual assault accusation, Biden is just struggling with visibility in the wake of the pandemic being declared. And after the debate that he had with Bernie Sanders, he just struggled to say or do much of anything. He had a few sort of disastrous appearances that were televised through teleconferencing. And then he had the CNN town hall, which is also, by the way, interesting that that Biden got invited to a CNN town hall, but as far as I know, Bernie Sanders, his rival, has not, which seems to be a violation of the equal time rule. That's a tangential issue. Then he's also facing simply an enthusiasm gap. There's polls showing that Biden is basically, enjoying half as much enthusiasm among Democratic voters as Trump is among Republican voters. This seems like really bad news for the entire country.
Yeah, I believe that the ABC poll about the enthusiasm had Biden actually at the worst, the lowest gap of or level of enthusiasm among Democratic voters of any modern Democratic nominee, which is an incredibly bad sign. He's actually below where Hillary Clinton was many months from now in 2016, I'm sorry. So he's already below where Clinton was. And of course, we know what happened with the Clinton election. Whereas Trump, his base is very enthusiastic. And there's been a lot of talk about how the need to kind of increase turnout because if Trump's base is mobilized, especially now that he's an incumbent president, how are you going to meet him? How are you going to be able to combat him and mobilize your own base to come out? And it doesn't seem to be working with Biden. And I think what this tells us is that there has been evidence, since Biden made his really miraculous comeback after South Carolina, that Democratic voters weren't picking him because they thought he was necessarily the best candidate or because they liked his policies. Many polls, Bernie Sanders was the one who was most trusted on some of these most important issues like healthcare. And actually, even if you look at the exit polls in the primaries that have happened, and including the states that Biden trounced Sanders in, exit polls show that people voters were very positive towards Medicare for All, which of course is the policy that Biden has kind of organized his campaign against. But not just that, in the South Carolina poll, for example, even something like 49% of Biden voters said that they thought that the economic system of the United States needed a, quote, complete overhaul, which points to, I think, what we've seen is Democratic voters have been told for really years, but if you want to go broader than that, decades, that Biden, or at least the kind of candidate Biden is and the kind of candidacy he represents, is the most safe, least risky kind of candidacy to run against Republican. I think this election has really been, there is of course the matter of the Democratic establishment coalescing around Biden, and that really was key. But the other thing is that the media coverage of the race has consistently painted Biden as the most, the safest choice, the one that people should choose if they just want to get rid of Trump, if they want to end the nightmare of Trump. And Sanders is sort of presented, if not, outright negatively, then at least as someone who is, because he's a socialist, because he's too left-wing, well, the maybe Democrats might like that, but the other segment of voters just won't. And so it's not a great idea to choose him. There was actually a really good study by Sarah Lazar from In These Times, who looked at the coverage of the 3 days that followed. On the one hand, Bernie Sanders' win in Nevada, his landslide win there, and then Joe Biden's landslide win in South Carolina. What she found was that Sanders, in the 3 days that followed his big win, was covered much more negatively than Biden, linked to Russia and Putin. People talked about, how he was potentially a risk in the general election, that kind of thing. They actually, CNN had Biden on to discuss Sanders' win, but they didn't have Sanders himself. And they had Biden on really just to go on and attack Sanders. Whereas when it was Biden, he received something like $70 million of free media in the days after South Carolina and leading into Super Tuesday. If there was negative coverage, it tended to be sort of about how he can improve his campaign, how he can beat Bernie Sanders. So I think we're seeing the fruits of that is that Democratic voters have kind of fooled themselves into, because they're thinking about, instead of what do we believe in and what do we want, they're trying to think, what is this imaginary voter that you know, in the general election want, and let's vote on the basis of that, which really is a, if you look at the history of centrist establishment friendly candidates in the history, in the presidential history of presidential elections in the United States, that tactic has not gone very well. You know, Carter, Walter Mondale, Michael Dukakis, Gore, Kerry, Clinton, these candidates lost really, really badly to often extreme right-wing Republicans. And, you know, anything can happen with this pandemic raging, but Biden's response to it does not inspire confidence that, you know, he'll be able to overcome this kind of historical trend.
Right, and Biden doesn't seem to have, you know, even taken note of what Americans are going through during this pandemic, when more and more Americans are struggling with the issue of healthcare. Already, healthcare was the top issue of concern in the, you know, among the electorate. The coronavirus pandemic has highlighted the problems with our, you know, non-existent healthcare system. Before the pandemic hit, Biden said that he wouldn't veto a Medicare for All bill if it came to his desk as president. He has now maintained that he would still veto it, that he, that the coronavirus has not changed his mind on Medicare for All or a single payer system. So he's basically, it seems like, coasting toward what he thinks will be the nomination and expecting the country and Democrats to rally around him. He doesn't seem to be lifting a finger to actually work to win over voters.
Yeah, the messaging around that is I think, a really grave mistake. I think in the, you know, what, 3 or so weeks since the pandemic really took hold and this really became this global crisis, you know, things have moved fast on a daily basis, let alone a weekly basis. And, you know, even now you're starting to hear in sort of establishment media, you know, CNN, New York Times, you're starting to hear the kind of critiques that Bernie Sanders and the broader left behind them has been making for a very long time about the private health insurance system in the United States. You know, the fact that if you lose your employer, you know, you're suddenly, you're without insurance, you're in a very vulnerable place, that that employer-based insurance isn't, you know, the safest or, you know, this beloved system that that kind of centrist candidates have been saying for a year going into this. But Biden hasn't shifted that message. You know, in the town hall, for example, Anderson Cooper challenged him directly about this. He said, well, you know, people are now, I think it was 3 million people had gone on the unemployment rolls in a week, which means, you know, many of them had probably lost their health insurance. And he said, you know, isn't this a problem? And he said, no, my health insurance system, my public option, you know, is still the best thing. Medicare for All would not be good. And he said quite bizarrely that his plan would cost $1 billion, which, you know, his campaigns estimate $750 billion. I'm not sure how you get the discrepancy of $749 billion, but there you go. And, you know, and another revealing exchange in that town hall was there was a voter who asked him, you know, her partner was out of work. Her employer didn't provide health insurance because it's a small business. So they were paying $2,000 a month for their health insurance. And she was saying, you know, one, what happens when my savings run out? I mean, what am I going to sacrifice? Rent, food? And Biden didn't really address her problem at all. You know, he just said, he pivoted to the lawsuit, the Republican lawsuit against Obamacare, and he said, we have to defend Obamacare. And of course, Obamacare has nothing to do with this. I mean, you know, people are having problems with their health insurance, you know, for the entire decade since Obamacare passed. So, you know, what this points to is this longstanding allergy by Biden, of Biden's, to call for government programs. You know, Biden in many ways is really ill-suited for this particular historical moment, because his career is based on and built on cutting government programs, cutting government spending, trying to shrink government. This is what he's tried to do since at least the late 1970s. He had a bill that he put forward called the Federal Spending Control Act in 1977, which would have basically put every federal spending program on the chopping block every 4 years and force its manual authorization, reauthorization, or just would have eliminated it, which would have obviously, potentially endangered many, many government programs to do with health and other matters. He supported Reagan's budget cutting. He supported Clinton's budget cutting, all of which undermined public health. He voted for the balanced budget amendment 3 years in a row, which is this Republican basically scheme to be able to kind of shrink government and slash government programs and keep government spending to a minimum. And so now he finds himself in this place where all those rules, all those political rules around how big the government can be and how much you can spend have really gone out the window, because we just saw, a $2 trillion bailout bill just get passed with no talk about how is this going to get paid for. Actually $6 trillion if you look at, the lending authority given to the Fed there. And so he's the question for him is, I think, is he going to be able to shrug off that the kind of philosophy he's built his entire career on now, and embrace bolder government action? And so far, the indication is that he can't. But right. I guess we'll have to see.
Right. I should also mention that he has refused to have any more debates with Bernie Sanders, leading one to wonder what it is that he's afraid of. Branko, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate having you on.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Branko Marchteach. He's a staff writer at Jacobin Magazine. His new book is called Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. We've been discussing Biden's flagging presidential campaign. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.